Okay, everybody, good evening. Let's see, what should I do with this? I'll just keep this here. Okay, tonight we begin the second in our series entitled The Wise Son, the Ladies of the S&P, the London S&P Community. As I mentioned last time, we've titled it The Wise Son because of this surprising phenomenon that the majority of, written contributions to Anglo-Jewry were actually produced by ladies, certainly before the 20th century. And that is something that has often actually gone almost unnoticed by many historians. So actually, it's a common trope among histories of Anglo-Jewry is the lack of intellectual contributions, and kind of the lack of rabbinic writings and kind of scholarly Jewish activities, advanced yeshivot, things of that sort. And it's kind of a thing people kind of often reflect on, why is that the case that didn't develop in England despite a sizable, Jewish community. And yet, while that is true about, the community broadly speaking, what's interesting is that in contrast, you have something that happens in England that you don't really find in other Jewish communities, which is this development of ladies who produce works. And that's something that you don't, of Jewish content, and that's something you don't find in other places. And so in a lot of ways, what happens here is unique, and I think is important for us to appreciate. And that's why we kind of think of, who is the wise son of the community, the wise son of actually they are the ones who produce this type of literature. So we're going to take a moment to just step back to where we were last session to just very briefly review the context for this conversation. Because one of the things that we started to see last time was that the writings don't happen in a vacuum. They aren't purely, academic in essence, but they're actually responding to different challenges of that time. Of course, the time that we're talking about is the 19th century. This has actually been really fun for me to prepare this series because I've always kind of been interested in the 1700s and kind of the beginning when everyone community's kind of getting set up, and then you kind of think of contemporary times and there's this whole century between that I actually think most people actually probably even in our community broadly don't know much about. And that made this really interesting to kind of say, well, how did we get from there to here? And this is how we did it. This is how we got there. So I thought that this series was actually, for me, a lot of it was filling in a big gap in my understanding of the community. So what's the context? Are there any things that are happening at that time from the last class?
Well, this is, so in general, the Anglo-Jewry
we mentioned there's some things that are happening around them. Right, so there's the rise of reform, right, that's happening. Right, so reform is taking place. Yeah. Right, as we saw, both lowercase and capital are happening, right? There's reform that's happening within the Bevis Marks itself, as well as the reform, right, the first breakaway synagogue reform congregation, which is in 1840. But what else is happening? What else is going on? Yeah.
Anti-Semitism.
What do you mean by anti-Semitism?
Well, I think...
We can always say anti-Semitism, so...
I think there was I think perhaps as more Jews came to live in this country, so people became aware of them, and some of them were not particularly happy.
So how did that manifest? That's the question. How is that manifesting? Right, that's one of the things the Jewish community is responding to. But how's that manifesting?
Was it partly economics?
Well, no. I mean, that's the irony of it. Right, because historians often refer to it not as anti-Semitism, like people beating up Jews and that type of anti-Semitism. Right, in fact, they refer to it as philo-Semitism. Right, that there actually was this liberal tendency happening in England. England was a very liberal state at that time. You think of their movements to abolish slavery, right, and also to be more inclusive. Right, they permit Catholics to be in Parliament. Right, there is actually this spirit of inclusiveness that's happening. So what's actually happening, though, vis-a-vis the Jewish community?
Speaking of Parliament, is more or less at the time when the first Jewish MP
got elected, but didn't take the seat.
So this is still before. So one of the debates that's going on is the question of emancipation, right? Is the question of, fine, Jews are in the country, but how much are they going to be permitted to participate, right? Jews have been here for a very long time, right, since the 1860s. But the question is to what extent will they be able to be full participants in, shall we say, the government or the leadership of this country, right? They're able to be here to live, to trade, right, and to kind of live freely as citizens, but to actually be one of the kind of government of a Christian country. We're going to let Jews do that? Like, how, that doesn't make sense, right? So debates are happening about that. One of the other major challenges that's happening at that time is the question of conversion, right? There's major conversionist attempts that are taking place, right? And that'll be something that we're going to talk a lot about tonight. So there's the general issue of conversion. There's the issue of maybe not even conversion, but what we would say is assimilation as well. Right? Question of assimilation. There's the fight for full emancipation that's taking place. And then there's also the development of the reform movement as well. Reform is responding to some of these different issues, but then there's going to be the traditionalists that are going to be responding to these issues and also to reform as well, right? So there's going to be a whole bunch of those types of things that will be taking place within the broader community, right? So this is the context. These are the challenges that are happening. As we mentioned, this is the first time in the history of Anglo-Jewry, probably, that the majority of the Jews living in England are native-born. Okay, that they're native born. It's not going to be that case until you get to, you know, maybe after the Second World War, that will be the case again in this country. Imagine that there's going to be a major influx of Central European, Eastern European Jews that will take place starting in the 1840s, 1850s, and that's going to go all the way up until after the Second World War. Right. So it's really only going to be once you get to a generation after the Second World War that you might say, for the first time since, you know, the 1820s, right, that you would have had a native-born community here, right? And we mentioned that a lot of these things are probably happening as a result of that, right? You're native-born, you feel comfortable, so maybe you're assimilating, right? Maybe there's maybe even some interest to kind of fully participate in the society. You want to be emancipated, you feel that this is your country, you want to take a larger role, right? But you want to figure out how to make your Judaism fit with what's happening, right? So there's going to be all these things perhaps coming as a result of the broader context, which is maybe the fact that there is a native-born population. Right? In other words, right, there are Jews that feel British, right? Perhaps for the first time that the majority of the Jews that are here feel part of this country. Okay, so those are the broader challenges that are happening. This is going to be the context for all of the lectures we're going to have in this series, because all the ladies that we're talking about are essentially going to be during these years. Okay, so we mentioned that ladies play this unique role. They pick up the pen, right? And that's going to be a major contribution they're going to make. We're going to be looking at what does that mean, right? And that's really going to play out tonight in this lecture in the sense of what are they attempting to do? How are they looking at themselves? How are they being seen? And that's going to be one of the big questions that comes out of this. And the thing that's significant is the fact that this is happening seemingly in the absence of men. Now, not entirely, because you do have rabbis or ministers that will be doing some writing, if not independently, collaboratively with these ladies, right? So almost these ladies are doing things under the auspices, in some respects, not necessarily tonight's authors, but we're doing it kind of in the broader process, or a sense that this is a collaborative effort, or that it's part of a broader objective of also the kind of the rabbinic leadership, right? But it's ladies that will be taking. Well, the question is why. Last time we looked at Abigail Lindo, we saw Abigail Lindo. She produced one of the kind of early vocabulary, Hebrew vocabularies, and those types of works as aids, right, for children that are learning, teach them Hebrew, teach them what the prayers mean. And we saw that she did that, right, together with the rabbis in the community. After the lecture, my mother contacted me. And she said, I Googled, you know, Abigail Lindau, I couldn't find anything about her. And I said, that's right. I said, she's probably the most obscure of all of the figures, even though she actually is important historically, is one of the first ones to do that, right, to find some of the texts. Last time I had to actually go to the British Library in order to find some of her texts because they're not otherwise available. Tonight's person, Grace Aguilar, is probably the most prolific or the most well-known of all of the people that we're going to talk about within this series. Maybe you could say Lady Judith is the most popular, but only on account of the fact probably of who she was married to, right, that made her so particularly well-known. But Grace Aguilar was certainly the most well-read of all of the people that we're going to be speaking about. And her writings you can actually find online, right? You can actually just Google her and you can find PDFs, you know, of those original kind of writings that you had that you could just download and read, you know, on your, on your device. And so she's actually was very well known. She's very famous. Some of the things she wrote continued to be kind of given printed or given out to children into the 1950s. I mean, she was a really well-known figure. And what is interesting about her, and kind of look at this, she wasn't only well-known within the Jewish community. She's actually well-known within the broader community. Within, you know, English society as well. And beyond that, really an international figure. So she is a celebrity of sorts. She is really quite prolific and is kind of in anthologies of kind of literature from England, though often at least maybe something of hers even included in that, right? So she's considered to be kind of an important figure within 19th century English literature. She might not be Bronte, right, but she is an important writer nonetheless. So let's talk a little bit about who she was, right? Who was this Grace Aguilar? First of all, let's just talk about her lifespan. She was born in 1816 here in London and dies in Frankfurt, Germany, where she had gone to visit a brother of hers when she had been quite ill, hoping to recover. Fortunately, did not recover and passed away at a very early age. Okay, so she only lives to the age of 31. So she has a very short life, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a moment. Where did she come from? Her parents were Emmanuel and Sarah, both born in 1787 in Portugal. Her family actually had been conversos, right, had been people that had been in Portugal, certainly her family had been, or at least her grandparents had been, and they make their way out, I think to Amsterdam and ultimately to London, and that will be an important part of her story, is the fact that there will be these elements, right, of a very strong connection to the experience of the Portuguese Jews having lived in Portugal, essentially living double lives as Catholics, fear of the Inquisition, persecution, right? Not from 1492, but in the 1700s, right? Meaning still very much alive with that reality of the suffering and the persecution that converted Jews faced in Portugal over the centuries, right? And that becomes very much part of her kind of family lore, and it will find its way into many of her writings, right? So she is not, I would say, simply kind of Sephardic in the fact that that is her ancestry. She is deeply connected to her Sephardic ancestry. It is very much part of her identity, right? Her family literally had come from Portugal. And so in that way, it is very much plays an important role kind of in her thinking, perhaps in what her objectives are, but also in what the content of what she's going to write as well. And we'll look at some of her contents a little bit later on. She dies, as I mentioned, in 1847. She has two brothers that live into the 1900s, right, early 1900s. So, you know, she has a very short life. Other members of her family live longer. But just to kind of quickly go through her kind of trajectory, she didn't live her whole life in London, and in part will play a role in perhaps some of her content that she adds into her stories. She, at the age of 12, her father becomes ill, and the family moves to Devon, okay? So already in right? In 1828, the family goes to Devon, okay? Family goes to Devon. And then a little bit later, in 1835, they move to Brighton. Some people suggest perhaps to be at least closer to London, to be closer to Bevis Marks. And then ultimately, the family returns in 1840, right, to London, okay? She will continue to nurse her father's health. Her father will die in 1845, right? Right, and then she herself will pass away in 1847, right? That's Grace. And then her mother will pass away in 1854, and that will be important as well. Okay, so that's a little bit kind of just the quick overview of her life. So let's talk a little bit about that. During her life, she wrote 12 books. Six of them were published during her life. And six of them were published posthumously by her mother. Okay, so when historians kind of look at her writings, they're kind of looking at, you know, her published works, but then if you kind of add together when all of her things are written, you kind of see a different landscape of what she produced, and when she was writing it, to kind of see trajectories of her life, you know, what stage. I mean, she lived a very long life, but you know, what is she writing in her late teens, what is she writing in her 20s, and what's she writing in her late 20s? And they actually kind of identify almost three stages to her writing and the kinds of things that she's thinking about. And so she's interesting. She writes also many other things. We'll talk about the many other types of writings that she has. She's prolific in her writing. And in a lot of ways, she's unique. And she's was actually often looked at as this kind of singular type of figure, this kind of, you know, there's nobody like Grace, you know, out there. In a lot of ways, really, she's not unique. I mean, at the end of this course, we're not going to think she's so unique in the sense that we're going to see many ladies that have done similar things. But she is unique in the fact that she produces a much larger range than anybody else, and much more than anybody else, and becomes much more well-known than anybody else, right? So in that way, she is singular, but she's not singular in the fact, in the way that, in the sense of what she's doing, right? There are other people doing what she's doing. She just does it more and does it better or more successfully than other people. But she's not a complete kind of, she's not a completely different type of figure, which to me makes her even more interesting because she's actually part of what I'd like to say is really a movement. Right, that there's a whole movement that's happening, which to me makes it more significant than just being like, oh, one person happens to do something, in which case that doesn't necessarily tell you very much about society or about what's happening in the Jewish community. So in some ways, talking about her is helpful because she was so well known and did so much, but in some ways it's unhelpful once you do it in the context of a course like we're doing to get the sense that she's one of a group of ladies that are doing this type of work. I don't have so many pictures for this early part over here, so I'll just keep standing over here. She's interesting in that, and we'll see this in some of the other writings that we do. Actually, you know what, let me pull up one of the pictures I have here. Sorry, I'm gonna need to restart this. So here you have on the first page over here is a picture of Grace. Now, as I mentioned, she dies relatively young. She'd actually been unwell for much of her life. She got the measles when she was 19, and many of the kind of things about her always talk about her slight frame, right, and that she was kind of a bit sickly. Some writings about her kind of said, well, you know, she gave her life to her writing. You know, that she devoted herself so much to what she produced that she didn't take sufficient care of herself, you know, and kind of maybe made that bargain in her life. Who knows? But I guess this appears in one of her publications, right? An etching, a drawing of what she looked like. But let's go down over here. Okay, so over here you have one of her writings. Now this one actually was produced after she died. This one you can see on the bottom page. It says 1851, even though this particular book, The Vale of Cedars, is one of the early things that she actually wrote. Okay, but what you find on here, and this is actually something that you see with some of her other writings, is it says, by Grace Aguilar. Now that shouldn't seem to be particularly surprising, unless you look at the other writings from the other ladies we're going to talk about, that typically don't say who wrote them. For example, well, we'll see this next week when we talk about, or next month when we talk about Lady Duke Montefiore. The thing that she writes, her cookbook, it just says by a lady. It doesn't say her name. In fact, many of the writings do not say who wrote them. They're published anonymously. And that she doesn't do. She actually puts her name on there, which is a bit of a risky move at that time, and it will play into what her objectives are, because it's considered to be almost unladylike to seek acclaim, right? If a person produces something for the sake of the betterment of society, well, that's okay, right? That's okay for a lady to engage in those kinds of activities because she's doing it for others. But to do it for herself, that's not the kind of thing that ladies do. But she did do that. In fact, we know from some of her private writings, I almost feels wrong to read people's private writings even many years after they passed, She felt it would be incredibly satisfying for her to be well known for the things that she wrote. So that was something that she appreciated, as I mentioned, everyone really does. Her name, therefore, does appear in many of the things that she writes. And that was something that was different about her as well. It may have something to do with the fact that she was middle class. Many of the other ladies we're going to write, read or study about were actually from a more upper class society, perhaps not seeking notoriety in the same way, but middle class, you know, you got to, you know, right, you're aspiring, right? And that's part of the aspiration. And so she does. She does identify with at least a lot of the things that that she writes. The thing that will be most complicated, or I would say most hotly contested about Grace, is how to define her, because of course we love to judge people, right? So how exactly are we meant to define Grace Aguilar? And this might not mean so much right now, but as we go into her writings, it will hopefully make more sense. But the question is how is she meant to be seen, right? Is she a traditionalist, or is she a reformer, right? And in essence, and we'll play this out more as we go through the as we go through the lecture. But on one hand, she is doing something that is uncommon, right? Doing all these types of writings, right? So in many ways, seems to be somewhat of a reformer, right? Pushing the envelope, changing, you know, mixing things up. And at the same time, many things that she's writing is advocating a traditional lifestyle. And so you find among historians kind of this push and pull between people who kind of regularly refer to her, you know, as a reformer and people who refer to her as a traditionalist. I mean, what should be stated is that she is not part of the new Reformed synagogue that would be set up. She's part of Bevis Marx, right? So she never, in a sense, goes and aligns herself with the reforming sense of, you know, capital R. On the other hand, she will advocate for certain reforms to take place. And that leads many people to kind of see her as a reformer. Though as we mentioned in the last lecture, reform is not unusual even within Bevis Marx itself. In Bevis Marx itself, we know in the 1820s, reforms are passed. Not reforms in terms of, you know, abolishing the second day of holidays and, you know, those are, you know, introducing music, musical instruments into the synagogue, but there will be reform in terms of the service, right? The introduction of a choir, the introduction of an English language sermon, the changing of the responses during the service so that it should be less back and forth, but more kind of the chazan will lead the service throughout, and people kind of just maybe quietly follow along and not kind of have this back and forth that would have been traditional and we actually still find today in many Spanish Portuguese synagogues. So, and the opening of new, even new schools. I mean, there's a broader sense going on, even within the traditionalist camp, that there need to be certain changes. There will be debates about how far those changes should go, or is really probably what's partly going with that capital R reforms in London. It's not even always so much about ideological changes, it's just the fact that they want to open up a synagogue in West London, and Bevis Marx says only one synagogue is allowed in the city. So whether the reform, actual start of reform synagogue was really being driven by practical necessity to just open up a second synagogue or was actually being driven by ideology is another question. Certainly when we think of German Jewry, we think of reform as an ideological movement. In London, maybe less ideological and more practical. But be that as it may, in that sense, you know, grace is, and we'll talk about this more at the end after we've looked at some of her things, you know, in a lot of ways she is part of reform in that she's kind of advocating certain kinds of changes and will even make certain people uncomfortable with some of the changes that she makes, but she is not reform with capital R, right, in that type of way. So in some ways, she seems reformer. Later, feminists will kind of use grace as a way to kind of be like, you know, oh, she's like a precursor to later feminist movements, and other people will say that that's going to be an unfair kind of identification with her. Well, I'll let you be the judge, especially those of you who perhaps end up reading some of her works, you know, where she actually fits into that question. But I think in order to probably understand it, she has to understand in the context of the time she's in, as opposed to just kind of maybe our modern expectations of what that time had actually looked like. And we'll see a little bit more about what that means. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, it's all been kind of almost introductory. I feel like a lot of the lecture will kind of be like this because we're not actually going to just read through all of her books together in this hour. If you walk out of this lecture wanting to read one of her books, I'll consider that a success. Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about her worldviews because that will be important. And again, we'll see this then bear out in some of her writings. But there were certain things that are identified as part of, you know, her worldview, things that she will advocate in her writing, right? And that's going to be something which is interesting about her writing, and it's something that's not altogether different than what you find in Victorian writing in general, is that most of the writings are moralist in nature, right? They're trying to convey certain ideas or principles, right? Writers are trying to influence society. They're not just simply writing books to be, you know, just for entertainment's sake. They're not writing books just to kind of, you know, make a buck, right? But they actually, they're very moralist in their, that they have messages, right? You can't kind of separate the fact that there is kind of an objective to the writings that are taking place, right? And that's true of all of the writing that's happening, or much of the writing happening in Victorian England, not even outside the Jewish community. And that's certainly the case with Grace Aguilar as well, right? That when she is writing, she is trying to imbue her writing with certain lessons or ideas that she thinks are important for people to embrace. And she has a number of different kind of worldviews that she kind of weaves into her novels, though as I mentioned, she writes other things as well, which we'll talk about. So this is gonna be true not of her novels, but also kind of some of her more ideological writings as well. But for one thing, she has erase some of this. Right, she has a view of what I would say is kind of what you would say is kind of traditional family. Right, she definitely has this image of the traditional family, right, of where the man is outside the house, and you have the wife, which is inside the house. She never marries, right? And in some regards, some people say that she, again, also kind of made that trade, decided she was going to devote herself to her writings and not to marriage. She just wasn't interested in marriage. But she herself actually doesn't marry, but she does in her writings often kind of talk about this traditional family, right? That definitely is the way she sees it, right? That the wife is at home and that the husband is out in public. But that shouldn't surprise you from, or shouldn't, doesn't change the fact that she, though, advocates a particular role for the wife or for the mother, right? And that is, she has this idea of what she calls the mother educator, right? Right, that she sees that one of the roles of a mother is to educate her children. And in fact, it's almost the kind of, they're the primary educators in the Jewish community, right? So she sees herself that that is the role of mothers, right? To be nurturing, to be loving, and to actually educate their children, right? So it's not just, you know, oh, you have the children and, you know, you bake them brownies and, you know, you send them to yeshiva to be educated, but it's actually the role of the mother to educate their children, right? And this is also kind of fitting with kind of Victorian norms, right? We're talking about the wife is at home, the father's out of the house, the wife is the one raising the children, but it's but it's up to the mother to actually kind of imbue the children with values and ideals and, you know, equip them so that when they reach adulthood, they will be able to be kind of successful in the broader world. This drives her to an aspect that I would say is probably the primary thing that people identify her with as a reformer, right? Is it something that she advocates very strongly for, right? Is going to be ladies' education, right? She says, how is it possible for ladies to educate their children if they are not educated themselves, right? And so she says it's important that ladies be educated, and we'll see, she therefore, some of her writings are actually written in order to educate other ladies so that they can be knowledgeable about Torah, right, about Judaism. And she even says that women should be studying Talmud, that women should be studying Gemara, right? If you want them to be the ones to be the educators, then they need to be educated, right? And one of the things that people will lambast her with in some of her writings, they'll say, you know, some of her writings are, you know, not scholarly enough, or she made a mistake with something like this, or, you know, one, we'll see this later, you know, one rabbi was kind of like saying, you know, she should stop trying to be, you know, to be a scholar, you know, and that's her whole point, is saying, myself would be more scholarly if you would teach me, and then I could actually do that, right? So it becomes a catch-22 that, of course, I'm not going to be able to produce things that are really drawing from the Talmud if I've never studied it. And one of the things that we actually find is, we mentioned that she lives outside of London during kind of her teen years, and that she actually often, in order to study Torah, she will go to church. She actually goes to church because she wants to hear English sermons. She wants to be able to know what the Bible says. She'll read English translations of the Bible. One of the things she will advocate for is that there needs to be a Jewish translation of the Bible into English, which doesn't exist at this time. Right? It's amazing. Jews have been living here since, you know, the 1600s, but there's no English translation of the Torah. And so, again, when people kind of maybe accuse her of what they call her being, you know, like a Protestant Jew, she says, well, you know, where do you want me to study from? Right? I don't have access to Jewish sources because you haven't, you rabbis or whoever, haven't provided me with those tools. Right? And so that will be something that she will kind of, that she will advocate for, and that there needs to be more material made available. She's going to do her part to produce it. She produces it based on what she knows from reading the Bible herself and what she gets from Josephus, right? But in terms of kind of access to what we might say original Jewish sources, right? Classical Jewish texts, right? That's not available to her, right? And she, that's something that she quite strongly advocates for. So in that sense, people say, oh, you see, she's, you know, she's a reformer, right? But she's doing it in order to preserve tradition, right? So it's, so which one is she? Is she a reformer or is she a traditionalist? And then one of the other things that she advocates for, and this is important as well, right? She advocates, broadly speaking, a public-private split. Okay? One of the things she's going to be part of her her kind of worldview is the fact that Jews should be, you know, committed to being Jews, but that they should express their difference in private, not in public, right? In the public sphere, they should blend, mix with the broader society. They shouldn't kind of do their Jewish rituals, their distinctive Jewish rituals out in public. Those types of things are meant for in private. When I read that, it made me understand Anglo-Jewry in a way that I hadn't before, because Anglo-Jewry is much more private with their kind of public display of Jewishness in a way which is, let's say, different from the American Jewish community, which is much more kind of public with their Judaism. And that was something that she advocated. And that was almost, you could say, her contribution to the discussion about emancipation, right? Is this idea of saying, yes, we should be emancipated, because fundamentally Jews do fit with society, right? And one of the things she'll often talk about is that while the expression we give to certain values or ideas may be different, she argues that in essence, Judaism and Christianity are very much the same, right? And that some of the kind of core principles of charity and kindness and belief in God and worship and spirituality, right? Those are ideas that are shared between both religions, and yet we express them in different ways. And so we don't need to kind of express those things in public and create discord. Publicly, we can all share the fact that we share essentially the same, you know, Judeo-Christian values. And then private, we hold on to our rituals and we hold on to our traditions. And that was a value that she also interwove into her various writings, right? And so she definitely has views. She had opinions, right, about what Judaism should look like, what family life should look like, what the role of ladies should look like, and it's significant, right? I think she represents kind of this movement, and in that way was very celebrated as kind of this really significant person. But she wasn't without controversy, again, depending on kind of who you asked about some of her particular views. Any thoughts or questions before I go on?
Yeah.
Yes.
התווכחתי עם הבעל שם על איזה משהו שהוא שמע שאני למד איתו שבוע בבית ספר, הוציא את הילדים שלו מהחדר, הוציא לי ספר ואמר לי, פה רשום שלאישה אסור ללמוד תורה, כאילו משנה. עכשיו, באמת רציתי לדעת מה הרבנים אמרו לה.
So what Avipa was saying is that there are traditional Jewish sources, right, that say that as opposed to the written Torah, right, the oral Torah, Mishnah Talmud, is not the occupation of ladies, right? And that is a kind of a classical kind of distinction. Rambam even says, Maimonides says that, right? And so she's, in that way, being not traditional, because she's advocating that shouldn't be the case, right? She's saying, if you want us to teach our children, if you want us to live Jewish lives, we need to be educated as well. And to me, what's amazing about that is while there's still maybe certain parts of what we might call, right, say, the Orthodox community that maintains that division, right, there is a growing amount, even within the Orthodox community, that disregards that. That says, in practice, if you want ladies to live a Jewish life, they need to know how to. And the way you know how to do that is by understanding the sources and the texts and understanding where these things come from. Right? So there's an increasing number of even Orthodox, you know, institutions that include, again, different institutions to different degrees, right, aspects of the oral tradition, right, Torah Sheba'al Peh, into the curriculum for ladies as well. So in many ways, what she advocates ultimately is adopted, right, in part, even parts of the Orthodox community, you know, nearly, you know, 150 years later, right? So she's in a lot of ways really kind of ahead of the curve in that way, which is really interesting. So I know she's like a really, she's amazing, in that way she's a really amazing figure. And we'll reflect on that maybe at the end of the lecture a little bit more. So let's just very quickly talk about the genres, because she writes a lot of different genres, and then we'll talk about, some of the particular things that she does. So she does a lot of different genres. The first one that she does, which is very popular at the time, is historical romance. Historical romance, right? So that's taking, you know, some historic moment and writing kind of some kind of romantic tragedy type of episode that takes place in history, right? Historical romance was very popular in the early part of the 19th century. You'll correct me if I'm wrong, okay? Is that right so far? Yeah, good. Okay, fine. Then, she also writes something which changes, which is domestic fiction, right? Where you actually write about contemporary times, about family life, right? So something which is not, you know, some grand, you know, historic thing, you know, and then you're kind of weaving a story into some famous event. You're writing a story about just day-to-day life. You know, you think about, like, you know, I don't know, Pride and Prejudice. You know, like, just like lives of people, right? And so she'll write domestic fiction. Again, in all of this with Jewish content, about Jewish characters. She writes poetry. She's widely published in some of the Jewish newspapers that we spoke about last time. The Occident, which is produced in Philadelphia, right? The Voice of Jacob, which is produced here in London, right? Both coming out of the Spanish and Portuguese communities in these cities. She does some translations. Her father asks her to translate some polemic works into English, some Jewish polemical works. She writes the first history of Anglo-Jewry. So she is kind of the precursor to, I don't know how to pronounce the name, Picciotto? I don't know, Picciotto? I don't know how to pronounce his name. One of the, kind of the early historians, obviously Cicero Roth and so on, kind of the early historian. She's the first one. She's the first one to kind of take a step back and say, let me, you know, let's think about Anglo history. It's one of the last things that she writes. She also writes just broadly herself what we call apologetics or polemical works, right, where she kind of puts out kind of her ideas or, you know, things that she thinks are problematic. Okay, so she writes, it's incredible. I mean, she's a really young lady, but obviously very very gifted, very clever, and she does quite a lot. Okay, so let's see here. See if we can get that back. Okay. I'm hearing noises. Okay, we have to log in again. All right, I will try to keep talking while I do this. Okay. So let's talk about some of her writings, and then we'll, and this will kind of where we'll wrap, and we'll see some of the different ideas that we've been speaking about, kind of playing it out. Again, she wrote a lot of different things. As I mentioned, a lot was published in her own life, some of it was published after her life. Historians essentially look at, or a particular historian, I'll mention, this is a book here called The Origin of the Modern Jewish Woman Writer, by Michael Golshinsky. He's actually a lot. He's become the expert, I would say, on Grace Aguilar and kind of on Jewish female writers during this time. So he identifies by kind of looking at the entire collection of her writings, three different phases in her writing. He sees her early years as being part of this historical romance type literature. We'll look at that. He then sees kind of her second phase, which is, you know, some of these kind of more polemical type writings, and then kind of you have this last phase where she's going to kind of be writing works for the Jewish community. So she kind of has some different phases, and we'll kind of see how this plays out. But one of her first writings, and this one that was only published after her death, is called The Vale of Cedars. It was actually written for non-Jews, right? Many of her books were written for non-Jews and for Jews. It was one of kind of the challenges in her writing. How do you, you know, make something legible for non-Jews and not be boring to Jews then at the same time, right? So how do you, you know, things that Jews would take for granted, you don't have to explain what Passover is, but obviously if you're writing for non-Jewish audience, then you're going to go into that in detail. So she writes this book, The Vale of Cedars, and some of these writings that she does are when she's living, you know, outside of London, and she has friends that are not Jewish, and she has different, you know, kind of interactions with them, and so she'll write for their benefit, some of her early writings. I'll just quote to you a little bit of something that she writes to one of her friends. Yeah, let's see here. Yeah. Before I read this, let me just add one other point. What essentially prompts her, and actually prompts a lot of other Jewish writers, is Ivanhoe, Walter Scott's Ivanhoe, right, which is a historic romance taking place in 12th century England, where you have, right, a young Jewish lady, right, that kind of falls in love, right, has this kind of relationship, right, and there is this, you know, what's going to happen with her, right? And she falls in love, and there's this, kind of this thing that goes on. In that story, the lady doesn't convert. But there then will be other English writers that will then write almost kind of alternate endings to that story where she does convert, right? And what ends up being is there becomes this genre in a lot of English writing which presents kind of the Jewish lady, the single Jewish lady, as kind of oppressed by her Judaism, who meets, you know, an Englishman who she falls in love with and ultimately converts as kind of her escape from Judaism and into kind of this new life. And it's all kind of written in this very romantic way. And a lot of what drives that, right, is this sense, right, this conversionist attempt, right? So these books are not being written just as stories, they're trying to influence. Right? And one of the arguments is that, A, Judaism is oppressive to ladies, right? So, of course, they're going to want to leave being Jewish. And also that ladies are malleable, right? And so we can get the Jews through their ladies, essentially. And that's going to prompt a number of Jewish writers to kind of write their own versions of romantic fiction as a way to say that, no, we love being Jewish, and in our stories, our heroines will hold fast to their Judaism, and will not convert even under certain considerations. So, in this story that she writes, The Vale of Cedars, this takes place in Spain during the times of King Ferdinand, Queen Isabella, and it tells a story of a lady. Her name is Mary, Marie, and she falls in love with a British Protestant who's also in Spain at that time, Arthur Stanley, and she loves him very much, but in the story, she ultimately follows her father and marries a Jewish man, okay? But the story goes on is that her husband is murdered, and Arthur Stanley is accused of the murder, okay? And he's being taken to task he's taken into custody by Torquemada, right, by the Inquisition. Right, Protestants are also prosecuted in under the Spanish Inquisition potentially. Don't worry about it if the time scale doesn't quite fit. Okay, and again, it's fiction, right? And she has to decide what to do if she, in a sense, admits who she is, that she is actually a secret Jewess, she apparently will be able to get Arthur to be released, right? Because it'll clear up that, in fact, he wasn't part of this. Or, but then she will be liable to be put to death. Or if she remains silent, then Arthur will die. And in the story, she goes forward and admits that she is a Jew, right? As historians say, in a sense, showing that Jews can be altruistic, particularly towards England, right? She's saving a British Protestant, right? And even to the point of subjecting herself, but not because she's giving up her Judaism. She is, you know, saying very clearly, I am a Jew. As the story goes on, that there's apparently a moment where Queen Isabella is embracing her own daughter, and at that point, she kind of pleads for her life, and out of kind of a moment of kindness, Queen Isabella allows her to escape, and she goes back to the place where the Jews are hiding, which is, I guess, called the Vale of Cedars, like kind of this orchard where they're secretly kind of living out in Spain. And so the story kind of is trying to show the opposite, right? That we hold on to our tradition and we're even willing to kind of put our own lives in danger, right? We're even willing to help people who are not Jewish, right? So it has a lot of kind of lessons woven into it, one of which is being very proud of being Jewish, but also of being good to people who aren't Jewish as well. And this is a book that will be very popular after her death. Will become a well-known story, and she has several of these types of books that will be published, and it's part of a large movement of responding to Walter Scott's writing. Another book that she, or kind of a serial publication that she does, is in 1840, called The Spirit of Judaism. The Spirit of Judaism is a work that she writes in order to capture kind of the values of Judaism beyond the technicalities of the law, right? And what she feels is a problem that Jewish people are kind of just doing the mitzvot robotically, but not perhaps incorporating the values of mitzvot into their practice or into their lives. And so she writes something for her brother, right? So it's kind of almost an educational tool, and it will then be used by others in this way, right, to teach kind of the lessons or the values that one can find in Judaism. She actually, to get it first published, she sends it to Philadelphia, that it'll be printed in the Occident, which will have just launched at that time, which is produced by Rabbi Isaac Leiser, right, the minister there. It will get lost in transit from London, and she has to rewrite it from her notes and sends it again in 1842. In 1842, she gets her copy of the Occident and is none too pleased because Leiser does print her writings but intersperses it with his comments about where he thinks that she is wrong and things like that, right? So you can't actually just like read it straight to see what she says without actually seeing his reactions to it. Amazingly, though, even despite kind of some of his responses, again, pointing out things where he thinks that she's not correct or she's missed the point, again, where she might claim, well, what do you want? I haven't gotten a formal education. It will succeed. It will be something that will be reprinted and people will use it to study. And so it does find success. And what many say is perhaps one of her most important writings is Women of Israel by Grace Aguilar. And here what she does is she writes a book for Jewish ladies, which is about Jewish ladies. It's a series of kind of essays about different ladies from the Torah, from Jewish history, that are meant to be, you know, kind of examples, right? So kind of through their lives, she kind of teaches lessons, but also gives all of these examples of ladies that are leaders, and are judges, right? And are, you know, great mothers, right? Mother educators, right? So kind of all these things that she kind of thinks of, she shows that that's who they are. And this becomes like a really important work because there's something which is really trying to make the point about the significance of ladies, right? That ladies are not unequal, right? That ladies are equal to men in Judaism. It's perhaps you know, again, a nod to non-Jews. Don't think that, you know, Jewish women are not significant, because look at all the Jewish ladies they are. But it's also trying to tell Jewish ladies, right, this is your heritage. This is who you can be as well. And that's considered to be a really, really important work that she does. Apparently, it's that ultimate. It's read by Jews and non-Jews, and even given out to Christian children. Apparently, it was even given out to Christian children in like some Sunday school as late as the 1950s. You know, it's kind of like their gift. It's considered to be an important work, and certainly the first of its type in that regard. And so that's something that she does that's really important too. And then one other book that we'll just quickly take a look at is called The Perez Family, which is written in 1844. So again, also shortly before her death. And this book is written for poor Jews. We'll talk more about the context of this book when we do one of our later figures, Charlotte Montefiore. But she writes this for poor Jews living in England. And it tells the story of a lady named Rachel. Rachel is essentially a Job-like figure. She has everything. Her life is great. And then all of a sudden, there's a fire in her house. She has to escape. Her arm is damaged in the fire. One of her children goes at least partially blind in the fire. Her husband will shortly thereafter die. One of her sons will marry a Gentile. Her niece that's helping her. Her mother gets sick, and so she has to go back to her mother, right? It's all a mess. It's all a mess. Everything, you know, is crumbling around her. And yet in the story, Rachel withstands her values. She doesn't lose faith in God. She continues, you know, to believe in the justness of God and in Torah. And the end of the story, her child's sight returns. Her son decides to leave, you know, his Gentile wife, and comes back and marries her niece, right? So the cousins get married. Great. How good is that? Her younger son becomes a chazan, you know, like the dream. You know,
doesn't it sound like the Book of Job?
That's the point. So this is what they call domestic fiction, right? It's a story just taking place in a domestic, a setting that any English Jewish person in the 1800s would have recognized, right? It's a contemporary story, but what it's trying to do is present an idealized version of their lives, right? So what you're trying to tell people who are reading this story is you too can aspire to this, right? This is just another person like you, but they're doing it in this ideal fashion. You too can model yourself on, right? They're not writing these just as works of entertainment. These are meant to teach lessons. Whether they succeed, that's a harder question to say, right? Whether this actually is a successful kind of movement, right? A lot of people read these books even nowadays, not so much for their moral lessons, but just because, you know, they're great stories, right? People read, you know, the works of Bronte, you know, I don't know if they're taking lessons, but they're just great stories. So, you know, whether they ultimately, in a sense, succeed in their objectives, that's a different question, but that's certainly what they're trying to present. Right? This is the first Jewish domestic tale that's written. And it's a very significant text. But what's interesting about this one is that one is written for Jews. It's not written for Gentiles. And so in it, she's able to not have to kind of explain everything. It's meant for a Jewish person to read and pick up and just kind of get, right? So she doesn't have to do the dance that she tries to do in her early writings, which is to somehow, you know, write about one thing and not write about, you know, and how do you make it for Jews and non-Jews at the same time? She's able to find a way to mix it together. You know, and one of the things that she argues for, and I'm not going to read you some different quotes from her, right, is that, you know, the problem is that all of the depictions of Jews prior to this time have been written by Christians who don't actually know anything about Judaism, have a particular angle on writing about Jews, right? And so she's coming forward and saying, I'm going to write as a Jewess, right, what it actually is, right? And she's going to turn Jews into these heroic figures, right, and to show their kind of deep embrace. And so in that way, Grace Aguilar becomes a deeply revered figure in the Jewish community, celebrated. She's a gifted, you know, authoress who portrays Judaism in a positive light, in a way that is meant to encourage Jews to resist conversion, to demonstrate that Jews can be part of society, to show that Jews should hold on to tradition, should maintain even traditional families and mother educator type roles, right? And so in a lot of ways in the traditional community, she is a celebrated figure. But again, she also advocates certain reforms or changes or she herself is doing something which is different, which is a Jewish lady writing educational materials for people to study, right? And so in that way, reformers will look at her and champion her as well. So she somehow successfully actually becomes the hero of everybody. Maybe that's why she remains so popular. Some of her books sell hundreds of thousands of copies. I mean, she is a very widely read figure. And when I think about her, and this is where I'll kind of wrap it up. You know, when I think about her and I kind of look at this debate, you know, was she traditional? Was she reform? You know, what exactly was she? It really strikes me that she's Spanish and Portuguese. She's Western Sephardic, meaning that's what the community does, right? It maintains its traditions whilst at the same time being part of society. And it doesn't see that as a conflict. And yes, what that will look like may change as society changes. But it's not Judaism that's changing. It's just we're finding a way to do both at the same time, which is what we've always done as a community. And so there may be at a certain point where, yes, women will be more educated, or they'll play this particular role and things like that. And that's not a break with Judaism. That's just what it means to be Jewish, right? Is that, you know, we live in this world. We maintain, as she very strongly advocates, we maintain the rituals, we maintain the form. You know, in a lot of ways, she's a traditional kind of Spanish-Portuguese Bevis Marx Jew, right? She's not about to go join a Reform congregation. She believes that we should maintain the ritual, that we should maintain the form, but that doesn't mean that the way we comport ourselves in life can't evolve over time as the world evolves. And that's not evolving Judaism. That's just lifestyles change over time, and that's nothing to do with Jewish life itself. And so I think in a lot of ways, when I kind of look at the way other historians look at it, and particularly once I look at all this group of ladies that we're going to be looking at, these are just Spanish and Portuguese Jews doing what Spanish and Portuguese Jews have done and what I would hope they continue to do, which is maintain a commitment to Jewish tradition and Jewish ritual, but at the same time always find a way to embrace the best of the world around them. And that actually is, you know, what they saw as the ideal way to live a Jewish life, whether that's part of the legacy of being a converso, you know, in Portugal, of kind of maintaining your tradition in secret but participating with society. And now in England you can maintain your tradition, not in secret like you have to hide it because you're afraid you're going to die, but just because you do it more in the private sphere, but then in the public life you participate in society, that's simply the way that they've always conducted themselves. And so I think in that way Grace is just in that, you know, again, without getting into details of this thing she said or that thing she said, but broadly speaking, she's just a great example of what we would want, you know, daughters of our community to look like, you know, to be ambitious and to do good things, but to remain committed to tradition. And in that way, I think she's not really, you know, traditionalist in the way that people use the word traditionalist as kind of this kind of like solidified or ossified type of thing. And she's not a reformer the way we think of reformers. She's doing both because that's just what we do. And I think in that way, she's a great example. So as I said at the beginning, in some ways, she's a great example of, you know, the kind of this unique person. But in some ways, she's not unique. She's just doing what everyone else is doing. She just maybe is doing it better or doing it, you know, with greater scope. And so in that way, she's a good person to study, to kind of just see what the scope is. But then as we kind of go through these different figures, we'll kind of see that everyone is doing it, maybe in smaller ways or within kind of their own areas of expertise. But surely she did gain great notoriety. Sadly, a life cut short. Who knows what else she would have, what she would have produced. But I think she did produce so much, which really became a great legacy for her. Sadly, you know, over the years, her works have fallen, you know, into the cobwebs of history. So perhaps this is an opportunity for us to rediscover some of her contributions, whether for entertainment or for some messages that she laces her writings with. Does anyone have any questions? Yes, Jeff.
Can you compare to Emma Lazarus?
Yeah, we're gonna. I'd rather not now. We're gonna talk about Emma at the very end of our series. We're gonna talk about some other ladies in other communities as well. We'll be able to do better comparisons once we've looked at a few of these figures. But yes, Emma is definitely someone to look at. Yeah.
Well, just an observation that. The family seems to have left Portugal very late, if you're saying 1780s. I was just wondering if she spoke Portuguese at home.
So I don't know. I saw it being written that she left, that her parents were born there. I was wondering about the dates, if it actually maybe meant the grandparents. I need to double check that point. But at least from what I've written, it seems like it actually was fairly recent that she was actually getting stories. One of her stories talks about the earthquake in 1755. So again, I don't know if that's because her family actually lived through that earthquake / tsunami. So
yeah.
I need to double check that. But yeah. Yes.
Have any of her books been made into films?
Not that I know of. Though there is a collection of her writings that was published recently, as well as some kind of the reviews at the times that she wrote them by this author, this professor, Michael Koshinsky. So if you want to kind of see a whole collection of them, you can see his. Or if not, if you want to read any of the individual writings, you can find them all online nowadays and just download them to read. So I'm not sure if anything was done to them or not. I'm sure. Yes?
Can I just tell you something about the Jewish community in Brighton?
I was wondering if you were going to kind of...
By 1835, there was an embryonic, fairly small Jewish community, and it lived in a very, very poor part of Brighton.
Poor, okay.
Where the fisheries, factories were, and so on.
So anyone there at that point was poor? Jews.
They were poor,
yeah.
Yeah. The more wealthy Jews came along and lived in Hove.
Okay.
But where the synagogue is now, which is not used very often, backs onto the church, which was used by the poor people. And in fact, when the synagogue was built, the church gave up a bit of its land to allow passageway in that area.
Okay.
So if that's where they lived, that church is still there.
That would make sense. Interesting. Okay.
But it took another 30 or 40 years.
So they're more
established. By which time, this is hardly influenced on Montague Road and various other things based in the building.
Yeah. The synagogue there was Ashkenaz, though, yeah? Yeah. Yeah, good. Okay, well, thank you, everyone, very much for coming.